Eric, I'm going to ask first a question before I pass it over to Eric, and that is, if your batteries are big enough, during the time that LIPA is down, and you're feeding your photovoltaics into their inverters, and now you were saying you don't have enough load in the house, where's the excess load going to go? Could that excess load be used for charging those batteries? And yes, you're going to have some kind of a protection circuit to make sure you don't overcharge the battery, but at least for a period of time, the excess load could be battery charging. Is that possible, Dennis? NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'll wait for the four beeps.
JF for comment.
Thank you, Dick. No, not at this point. I really haven't got my head wrapped around all of the different parameters, because I do have a transfer switch. I do have several generators. I do have the solar on the building, or in the process of building the turbine to have the wind generation. And I have to bundle all that stuff into one place. And believe me, if all of it was working at once, I'd probably blow out everything that I had, especially if the power came back on. So, you know, it's a really it's a delicate balancing act. So I'm trying to work through it. I talked to some engineers in solar, and actually, they don't have a good answer. So I'm still working on it. Back to you, Dave.
I am guessing that there are some code issues here also. To really be up to the code where you've got independent energy generating capability, whether it be motor generator set, whether it be solar voltaics, whether it be a wind turbine, and anything else, you have the ability with, in the worst case scenario, of pumping voltage back into the system during the time that alignment is out there doing repair. And so the human safety factor is such that I'll bet you there's some poorly worded but very strict sounding code rules that try to control that situation. So if a person to be able to temporarily go completely off the grid, I'll bet you there's a number of roadblocks to doing that. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Y2HF with a comment from
I just got a little stroke of an idea. I follow it. Let's not care about putting energy back into the grid, but let's have a grid connection. And that basically goes to the battery charging. And that bank of batteries, by the way, I don't know if you've ever seen the type of batteries that they sell for solar. They're nice. They're tall. They're heavy. And they're like 600, 1200 amp hours. So we're going to take that low voltage, we're going to have our solar panel connect to basically a battery charger, charge those batteries. The batteries are going to feed a flywheel, a motor, and all it's going to do is spin this flywheel. And the output of the flywheel is going to be connected to an alternator, which is going to make your 60Hz on the output. By the way, we use flywheels in a lot of the broadcast facilities. They're not really expensive, they're not thick, but they can handle many, many kilowatts, so it's an interesting thought. Now you're isolated from the grid completely. You're only using the grid to charge batteries. When the grid goes away, who cares? You still have your wind, you still have your solar, you still have, you might even be next to a river and have a little turbine there. Anything that you can do to charge the battery, you can go. K2RIW, K2RIW.
Jay,
quick comment.
I think our power company does occasionally use flywheels, but I believe they're only to use for brief periods. What's your best guess, Eric? That flywheel system, if you were using it to supply your house, I suspect you could only do it for a certain number of minutes before it spins down. K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, let me change the name of flywheel with dynamo. Okay, so that way you don't have to think about doing line conditioning, because that's pretty much what you use flywheel for. Take care of gaps and dips and, you know, rapid changes or little breaks in the line. Flywheel, the inertia overcomes that. let's just think of it as a motor, a mechanical shaft, and a generator. That isolates you from the grid completely. How you power the motor is really the batteries that you have. How you charge the batteries is your solar panels. You can be using a little bit of stuff from outside, but when it's dark at night, your batteries charge to keep the motor going. You get the idea?
Yeah, in your broadcast industry, you have to be able to glide through momentary periods of where Loco is doing something high, low, or whatever, interrupted voltage. I wonder, does your system, when it's being powered by your local power company, does it continuously power the flywheel, and you're using the flywheel output to your broadcast station, or is it really run in parallel? The flywheel is kept running, but you flip a bunch of switches that flip you over to the flywheel when Loco does something not so pleasant. So is your system intermittently using the flywheel or continuously using the flywheel, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RA to be in the second end.
K2RAW, KE2EJ. Okay. If you bought a flywheel, okay, it's not something that you use once in a while. It's there full time. It isolates you from the source of energy that you're using. I'll give you a good example in terms of it's two different kinds, all right? If you're up on a mountain where you have sporadic power delivery and you want to keep the transmitter going, when that power goes away, you know that you're going to have a room full of batteries somewhere. And in that particular case, that flywheel has a DC motor in it. And when the power is running, it's being rectified and sent to that DC motor that's spinning the flywheel. Okay, and that gives you one kind of isolation and keeps you going when the power goes off. In a facility like we have in Manhattan, we need to be isolated from the garbage on the power line. So we're in essence making brand new power on the premises. And if there's any, you know, short permutations or little interruptions, we don't see them because the inertia of the flywheel takes care of that for us. K2RAW, K2EJ.
ACC with a quick comment.
Okay. Person who wants a quick comment, speak a little more slowly. Give me your call letters and your name, and then your comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, K2EJ. The only thing with that is, I thought, one of the major benefits to this whole thing with the solar is being able to sell back power to the utility. If you isolate it from flywheel, you can lose the ability to sell the excess power back to the utility. Back to you, Dick, KDPWA.
That was a given. I said at the beginning of the conversation.
Hold on now there, Steve. Eric, why, with the flywheel system, what stops you from wiring it correctly so you can still put power back into the local power company, KE2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, KE2EJ, the answer is simple, absolutely nothing. There's nothing to stop you from taking and saving that thing precisely to what's coming in. And by the way, if you're a real cranky guy and you like stuff, you buy your flywheel with three-phase output. But yeah, you can do that, or you can just take your DC and put it into an inverter and ship it back out. You can do it on the DC side of things too. But the whole point of the idea was to really keep you isolated from the grid, which this does, and you keep the county, legal, state, all those people happy because you're still going to be paying a few bucks for the connection to the electric grid and have your meter barely, if ever, move. It keeps them happy, so you're killing two birds with one stone.
If you do this whole thing 100% legal, where you have the ability to pump power back into Con Ed, Loco, New Jersey Power Line, whoever, and you want to be paid for it, I am guessing that when you make that request, they give you a special kind of a meter where the power that you consume, you pay at one rate. The power that you pay back, that you pump back to them, they give you a different and lower rate, guarantee they're not going to give you the full rate. So my guess is you've got a dual rate meter depending on which way the energy is flowing. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Believe it or not, the old meter will go backwards. But they like to put their new meter in because it communicates. They actually know what the demands are. They know where the switch is going. But what is really becoming this smart grid at a very slow pace. So, if you ever read the contract that you're signed with the power company when you do this, if you're doing it independently, you actually don't have to deal with that when you're using these new companies to power generating companies to start with. They specifically will not give you those rates if you have a battery run system. It's got to shut off.
NY2HO for comment.
Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you. Eric, listen, you do get a different rate when you sell back power to the electric company. One of the things that you actually want to do when you're sizing up a system, besides what your usage is that you don't want to have too much because it's going to be diminishing returns to sell back to the power company. So that's one of the things you want to balance when you're doing it. Number two, there was somebody before, and I'm sorry, I didn't answer them when they asked it at the time. The question was, what happens during an EMP? Well, you know, you can really bend over and you know the rest of the sentence. You're going to lose it. It's all going to be gone. So unless you've got a Faraday cage with your whole system or your whole structure, it's going to be gone. So EMP pulse is going to fry your system. Whether it's solar, battery, turbine, it don't matter. As long as there's a wire attached to it, it's pretty much going to be gone. Maybe somebody else has a comment on that. Back to you, Dick.
By the way, most of the commercial stuff is quite lightning tolerant to a degree. Even the solar panels themselves are dead, of course.
KE2HEC with another request for Aaron.
Now, the Polyphaser Company makes some very stoochy voltage-limiting diodes, impulse made for lightning protection, among other things. If I had a stoochy enough set of polyphaser voltage-limiting diodes shunting my system so that if ordinarily the peak of your 120 volts goes to 167, and if I've got 200 volts of diodes in there, so that anything above 200 volts on the 120 line, they become conductive, and the spike of voltage can't get very much higher than that. I think I can get a certain amount of protection by doing that. Nothing is perfect. I mean, you get a direct lightning strike of 50,000 amperes on your particular wire coming from the power company to your house. I don't think anything's going to protect you from that. But that's thank goodness, that's an extremely rare event. But I'm guessing, Eric, that with the right peak voltage limiting diode systems like polyphaser, I think I can drastically save some of my circuitry. Am I naive on that one? KE2EJ, K2LIW, the tech net.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Don't forget, I have a stick that is a lightning grabber, and I have to deal with that. Especially in the city, it gets grabbed more often than not. I get hit once in a while here, but the city can get hit all the time. You know, there is a way to deal with the biggest problem, really, let me say this. I'll give you an example. Is the magnetic field that it generates more than the electrostatic field that it generates. For example, being in a broadcast station, we have audio circuits like intercoms and stuff like that. It just so happens that they have, you know, the chicks that are input op-amp. They're called MIFET. And, you know, they're real high impedance inputs. You know, the MOS gates, literally. they don't survive. You know. But the transmitters, all the regular stuff, all the balanced garbage, have a certain degree of input and output protection, let's call it. And you can deal with it in a reasonable way. And the stuff that's built for power line, I'm going to drop. In the commercial environment and the consumer environment, the effort that they go through to provide a reasonable amount of protection is quite a lot. If you look at the MOV device and the inputs of the TV, you know, you can, they save you once or twice if you don't replace them well. It's too bad, they're done. But short of a direct lightning strike, but a nearby lightning strike can really create a lot of damage. But when it comes to things like power, which, you know, if you think in terms of medical care, that the power is powering, and that kind of thinking goes into producing a lot of stuff. Also, the electrical cars spell out a certain amount of this anyway. So, yeah, I mean, we get lightning strikes all the time, and they don't really go off the air. So, there you go. Picture on WKD here.
Can you see what it says, question, Barry?
Yes, hold on there, Steve. We'll get to you. And by the way, Steve, your signal is about 50% noise, 50% audio. I think you're on a handy talkie. The broadcast station in Plainview has something like a 300-foot tower, which is going to attract a certain amount of lightning. But you also are involved with the Empire State Building, where the peak of that mast is something like 1,500 feet off the earth. And so it gets struck many times per year. What in the world have all those broadcast transmitters done at the Empire State Building to protect them from a truly direct strike? That mast is absolutely directly struck, and how in the world do you protect from that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2RW, the TechNet.
Well, let me give you the short and simple answer. Right. The structure itself is a ground line, right? The mooring mast, all the steel in the building. So it's pretty good conductive ground throughout the building, even though the building would be more realized. So the shell of that building is, yes, steel, but the rest of it is brick. I mean, where we have the broadcast transmitters, there are flues for fireplaces, you know. Think about when that building was built. But the big kicker in all of this, every single broadcast antenna is that PC ground. So, you look at the broadcast antennas themselves, the elements like the bat wings or the delta wings. I suppose the diameter of the material is maybe about a quarter of an inch in that neighborhood in terms of the radial, stuff like that. So that's the first degree of lightning protection. Plus the fact that our coax is and that's a really good conductor, but once you get over a certain voltage, it breaks down. Teflon melts. But if at the input of the, in the case of the Empire State Building and what used to be the World Trade Center, when you had a drop. We have to combine stuff together, like the World Trade, we combine channels 13, 11, 9, and 7, and all into the same pipe, going into the same antenna. And we do that by using these gigantic cavities, which give you an incredible degree of lightning detection, too. So, you know, by the time it gets to the transmitter, the input, or rather the output tank surface is transmitted. Yeah, it feels it, but it doesn't mind.
Sounds to me like you're reasonably well protected, even though you take a direct strike at the Empire State Building many times per year. Slightly different subject, Eric. A week or two ago, I told you about Channel 17LP, WLIG-17LP. That they had a lockup of the video and a lockup of the audio. Looks to me like you fixed it, and for the last week it's been working like a charm. except late Saturday night, it went into the video lockup mode. Audio's still there, but the video lockup mode has come back. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Are you talking about the Channel 55 low power that's analog?
I'm talking about channel, it advertises itself as channel 17. I know, I wasn't smart enough to find out exactly what RF frequency it's on. Channel 17-LP, WLIG 17-LP. I think it's really on 17, but I'm not sure. Yes, it is analog. And it's and the over-the-air broadcast, it has gone back to video lockup, but the audio is still there. And if it repeats what it did a couple of weeks ago, eventually the audio will also lock up. KE2EJ, KQLAW.
KQLAW, KE2EJ. As far as I know, that thing was supposed to have been shut off 2 weeks ago, so. there's not supposed to be any analog transmitting anywhere. I think that's a forgotten child. I think it announces itself in plain view. I mean, the weakest thing you've ever seen.
Okay, you are plain view. It announces itself in plain view. Is it literally located in plain view, Eric said?
It's supposed to be. You know, I never actually bothered to look at the FCC site to see where it actually is located. But from what I remember, it's a translator for what is now CBS.
Yes, it does from time to time say it's CBS, as far as the programming is concerned. Now, because I announced this to you a week or two ago, and because it got repaired, I assume you talked to somebody and made it get repaired. Was I naive on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. You know, actually, I haven't been interested, but I could ask.
Why 2H have a comment?
Okay, yeah. We've got Steve and Dennis in that order. Steve, I know you wanted to make another comment. KD2HUC, K2RW TechNet. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Eric. So back on to that earlier topic about the solar system, considering the fact that we live in the Northeast and the price of fuel is so high, and considering the fact that, you know, they're probably paying, you know, less for the energy, LIPA or, you know, the utilities, than it's probably worth, do you think, is it your opinion that when you're designing a solar system, you know, a solar voltaic system, that maybe there might be some better cost benefits instead of trying to tie to the grid and sell the power back to the utility, if instead you dumped the power into some sort of resistance heating for either hot water or even the structure itself, would that be more cost effective than trying to sell the power back? KD2HUC.
I guarantee you Dennis has got some opinions on this, but Eric first and then Dennis in that order. KE2EJ, K2RW, go ahead, Eric.
Okay, well, let's say you want to be ahead of the curve and you don't really care what it costs. And you're not looking at it from the point of view of saving money, so to speak. There's a lot of things you can do before you can get the solar, and that's to what I did with my house is when I took it over, I literally took it down to the studs, put nice new insulation, much more modern insulation was in there. So now, without even turning the heat on in the middle of the winter, it never gets below 60 degrees. So the amount of energy that I have to pump into the house is not a heck of a lot less. They used to have an oil bill, something like, you know, $400 a month. Now I do it with gas, the way I had things set up, and it costs less than like $6 a month. So that's where you begin. And then go from there. Yeah, you can design a system if you're looking to add energy back into the system and get the advantages of paying less, sure. But but if you're looking at it from a technology point of view, in the long run, if you keep the house and the family and you keep passing it on, you know, their cost to operate the house is far less than it would be their maintenance to hook up this grid. So, yeah, but you can only amortize something like that over time. And then there's this maintenance thing, that how do you do it? Because batteries do get old, and things of that nature. Get your eyes up, you can't use that.
When it comes to great big spikes of energy from a lightning strike, direct lightning strike, picture the fact that the railroad tracks run all over the island, for instance. So you get miles and miles of exposed steel that can take a direct hit. And all of that, nowadays, almost all of our trains are electrically powered by that third rail. So the third rail can be hit, or the non-third rails can be hit. My guess is some pretty healthy protection circuits are required to maintain the integrity of that system. And maybe even then you occasionally get a failure. You might have some words on this one, Steve. KD2HUZ, K2RIW in the tech net.
QJF, I have a comment on that, Dick.
Well, Dick, I'm not going to speak for the signal department. I'll let Chris do that. But in the power department, unless we take a direct strike, 9 times out of 10, it's the signal guys who end up walking away crying, we'll say, so to speak. Just by the very nature of the system, the power system's a lot more robust. And we're able to take and absorb a lot higher energy spikes. And you can turn it over to JAF for more clarification on the signal aspect. KD2HUC.
I'm going to take Chris and then Dennis in that order. KD2JAF. Go ahead, Chris. K2RIW in the tech net.
I was kind of fading away, and then I heard that comment from the power department. Obviously, you know me, so hit me on my cell phone, so I know you are. we have Faraday cages, we have grounding that you would not believe, and it's still, we had the debacle in Jamaica probably about 5 years ago, where all their brand new equipment was absolutely decimated by lightning. When you think you're ahead of the curve with lightning, it seems like to always bite you because it's extremely unprotectable. It can jump all kinds of air gaps, regardless of the protection you have. We're getting better at it, but it still seems to be problematic. The older systems, believe it or not, were way more robust. They can handle a lightning strike better because you were really opening up 16-gauge wire. But now, when it gets to the electronics, it just creates absolute mayhem. So you have systems and redundant systems on top of redundant systems. You got to get you back after you have a strike. And we have a lot of strikes every year.
You know, Dick, when that well grows up and they use fiber optics, a lot of those problems go away.
Yeah, but they still have to put real power on that third rail. I don't think anybody's going to come up with fiber optics to feed power into that third rail. Because
I'm just talking signal.
I know you're only talking about signal, but I think that that electric train, once the start up at the station, I think he's drawing something like 10,000 amperes. Isn't that roughly the number, Chris?
Sorry, that's
not
something. What was the 10,000 ampere pull for our train you're talking about?
Yeah, your electric train, when it's starts accelerating, I bet you can easily draw 10,000 amperes on that 660 volts. Is that true?
Colleague in the power department could probably answer that better because we're pushing 750. And we have impedance bonds that run around for traction. It's run around insulated joints that are 2,500 ampere rated bonds. But we know that the newest equipment is actually drawing the most amount of current. We've seen it pull 14,000, 15,000 amps. But I can let my friend over in the power department speak about that better.
Steve, am I in the right ballpark when I say you can easily draw 10,000 amperes? Over here, Steve.
Yeah, I've seen them 10,000, between 10 and 12. The breakers will open at 13. So they actually dial the software and trains down for them this way. Their performance doesn't overtax the infrastructure. It's kind of the nature of the game. But in response to Eric's comment, we do use fiber optics. And hold on, let me let it drop. One of the biggest issues that we've seen as far as lightning is just inadvertent remote paths to lower ground potentials, which is fueled my discussion a couple of weeks ago when I was talking about the isolation transformer and all. We employ those as very good success as far as isolation. Help us detect during lightning events, especially when the running rails get struck. Because not only do they cause all kinds of grief to Chris, but they cause all kinds of grief for us too. That's you, Rick.
We're fine. They're going to pick up Dennis. NY2HF, G2RW, go ahead, Dennis.
Solar condens and grounds, we don't use them for lightning protection.
You got it, Dennis.
All right, let me sum up what's going on here. We got people talking about lightning protection, and we got people talking about EMPs. Listen, lightning protection is freaking easy. EMPs, you guys are out to lunch. It's going to go down. You're going to fry. When they had the last EMP strike, it lit up every telephone or teletype line and burned the papers at the end of the desk. And that was at a time when we didn't have a lot of technology. You guys figured it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And matter of fact, what should be doing is going online and seeing what's happening in the night industry. What's happening on the sun. You guys, wow, you are under the pit. So what I would say to you is, do your homework. I don't say that you have, but guess what? I don't think you did. Back to you.
Was that Ian? Is that?
And that was Dennis, NY2HF, and he used the word EMP. Now, the word EMP has got a number of meanings. A nuclear event, in other words, if you use an A-bomb or an H-bomb, it makes a very large electromagnetic pulse. And a lightning bolt, you could call that an electromagnetic.
It's the neutrons that kill frogs and make stuff.
Okay, but you get both a blast of neutrons as well as a blast of electrons, Compton electrons, I think they're called. You get all kinds of events. Well, the sun, I think we're using the wrong terms here. We use the word EMP and sun. There are solar events where the solar wind, because of expulsion from the sun, once per 50 years, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, the sun can create an event which, by Faraday's law, every piece of wire on planet Earth suddenly develops a ridiculous amount of voltage. And so, in the case of the 1800 situation where all of your telegraph lines developed such a high voltage that you didn't have to press down the Morse code key. the arcing over of all the keys acted like a short circuit, created fires and whatever. Lucky for us, that's a relatively rare event, and nowadays we've got some pretty fancy satellites that'll give you forewarning of this. We've got your SOHO-like satellites that are in Lagrange point number one, a million miles ahead of the Earth toward the sun. They're looking at the sun, looking for these events, and they give us a lot of forewarning. That helps. How well protected our system when one of those really big events comes along, that's another whole subject. So Mother Nature can from time to time really humble you. Anyone have any comments on all of the above, give me a call at K2RIW in the TechNet.
Mass corona ejection, that's what you think of it, Dick.
Good night.
could add one more thing to that, too.
Yeah, it's called CME, coronal mass expulsion. Yes. Boy, can I make an event. Go ahead, Eric.
Actually, the very regular CME events that occur on the sun all the time, it's just that it ain't pointed in the right direction, lucky for us, so to speak. That's why we haven't seen any of those really big events. But, as far as EMP goes, a lightning strike creates the equivalent of what we call an EMP, or a big electromagnetic pulse. And I experience them every time lightning hits them. That's why I was talking about the way a lot of the stuff is created to minimize those effects, because you've got many miles of wires in the plant, and there's many miles of antenna, if you want to call it that. Sorry, WKJ.
Y2HF
with
a comment. Go ahead, Dennis.
All right, listen, Eric. What you're talking about, lightning strikes, is a terrestrial event. What you're talking about with CME, is a larger event. You're not grasping what's going on. When you get a lightning strike, guess what? What you also have is a pulsar into the outer atmosphere, which goes in the next to something, electric universe. You are going to have a lot of problems. Number one, what's going on right now is we have a sunspot, which is actually called more on the minimum, which I talked about last time I was on this thing. And you also have a magnetosphere that is in retreat. If the magnetic poles are reversing, you've got a lot of things going on. Sorry, Eric. You're just not grasping what's going on.
Magnetic pole is decreasing. It doesn't go through zero in the process of reversing. It shifts around in a funny way. It's still in the Arctic area. It hasn't gone to the Indian Ocean. It hasn't shifted that far. But it is migrating. And yes, that Earth's magnetic field gives us a lot of protection. We're going to go through a period in which we get less protection as it goes through its reversal. And it does reverse every 25,000 years or some number like that. So, Eric, Dennis is telling us that the sky is falling, and we better get ready for it. I'm not quite sure it's quite that bad, but yes, there's a certain degree of vulnerability of all of our massive power systems and wired systems. There's a lot more to this story, but we've got other people waiting, so I'm gonna cut it off for the time being. We can bring it up again next week. We've got Joe, W2RYY, and K2MHR, both signed in, and they haven't had their turn yet. Joe, I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. W2RYY, K2RYW, and the Tech Man.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you got off on this tangent from the original question. It's kind of something else. So, I'll ask a question that's a little completely different from what you're talking about. How's that?
Remember in the beginning I told you that it's not a strict schedule that we follow. We go with the flow. When people are showing enthusiasm for a particular subject or even a tangent of that subject, I think a lot of good information got passed over the last 45 minutes or so. Even though, yes, it started off as light-emitting diodes substituted for pilot lights, and it branched off into EMP. Isn't that related? I'm kidding you. W2RYY, K2RYW. Go with your question, Joe.
Okay. I use DVDs to record shows in a recorder type of arrangement, and these DVDs are called, I think, a minus RW is what's on the disc itself. My question is, these things don't last forever. You can record so many times on these things, and then they seem to fail. But I've never come up with anything, any much information that I've seen, maybe I'm looking in the wrong place, of how to be able to determine how many read-write cycles you get out of these discs before they fail. Back to you.
Want me to answer that?
I sure do. I was about to give it to you, Eric, because you're in the business where you've got to do a lot of that kind of recording and re-recording. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer. KE2IW, the tech man.
Hi, let me ask this question. We're just talking about recordable DVDs or rewritable DVDs.
You got that one now, Joe.
I'm talking about the DVDs you put in a recorder like a Zenith DVD recorder. That's the kind of DVDs I'm talking about. I mentioned the specific type was, the disc is called minus RW. Some have plus, but most of them are minus RW. Back to you. WS to N has all kinds of them.
Okay, Eric first and then Paul in that order. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, first let me tell you, the whole series of different types of DVDs, there's DVD minus R, there's DVD plus R, there's DVD minus RW, and there's DVD plus RW. So RW means it's rewritable, means that you can erase it and put new stuff on it. Okay, DVD R, either plus or minus, you can only record once and you're done. Although all the different types of discs are based on an organic dye, right? And this organic dye actually changes over time, and it also changes with humidity and temperature. Most people don't realize it, but if you lay a DVD flat, you put it in a humid environment, it begins to curl up. If you put it in a very dry environment, it will begin to curl down. There's a number of reasons, but I won't go into it. But the fact that this organic dye is in there, just like most things, it degrades over time. Now, Kodak makes a DVD rewrite and DVD record that is based on a gold metallized particle within the organic dye. So what happens is the particle becomes a pit for the DVD, actually becomes fixed in place. And as the organic material behind it degrades, the gold plates stay in place. So they're archival type of discs, and they're guaranteed to last for at least 20 years. So that should help.
Yeah, you might have a guess, though. The particular DVDs he's using are called minus RW. Is there a rough guess as to when you make a recording, how long it lasts, or is there a rough guess as to how many times you can re-record on a minus RW type DVD and still have a reasonable bit error rate? Any guesses on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2IW.
Yeah, I have a pretty good answer for you. First of all, it all depends upon storage, how you've stored, what kind of environment, how much humidity, what's the temperature. Okay, anything that deviates from, say, 35-40% humidity at a range of, say, like 68 to 73 or 74 degrees, in either direction has a tendency to reduce its life. Okay, typically 5 years you're looking at, if you really take care of it. And if you really, really take care of it, and it's in a humidity-controlled environment, you probably get 10 years out of it, but no more. The bit early starts going up to the point that it starts macro-blocking on you, and eventually we'll get to the point where it won't even allow that.
MI2HF, good question.
But I was wondering the answer of how many times you can record and reuse that item. That's what I was really recording about. Getting at, I understand everything will eventually degrade after time, but if I use a thing periodically, once a week, record something, then watch it, then erase it, and then record again, how many times can I do that process, approximately? what would be your best guess? Back to you.
You got the US-2N.
I got all the system.
Eric first and then Paul, and I don't want to. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, to answer that question, actually, you can look on the manufacturer's website. Now, the manufacturer is different. Okay, GDK, Verbatim, various manufacturers. It runs anywhere, depending upon who made it, anywhere between 50 times and like 250 times, 300 times in that neighborhood. And after that, but don't forget, you're hitting it with a half a watt laser. You know, it's just 300 milliwatt laser. And you're, in essence, heating that material up. So if you time it right, it's a great. What you're doing is you're accelerating that process by the fact that you're writing onto it. So it has a limited life.
Paul, sounds to me like you've done quite a bit of writing, rewriting, and so on. And what kind of discs have you used? And of all the stuff that you record that NASA is pouring into your house, how many times do you get a chance to rewrite which kind of a disc? WS2N, K2LAW, you got a poll.
Well, he has the minus RW himself. Depending on what machine, the machine is important too. Magnavox, kind of shaky with them. I'm happy if I got 30 out of them, you know, over and over again. The best machine for minus RWs is, I would say that the Sheeper. I mean, that thing is like a battleship. That you can't sink that thing. It just keeps going. I've never had it fouled up ever. Many years, over and over again. The best machine with the best type of disc. You know, he's not going to go out and get this now, but is the Panasonic with the. DVD, they call it DVD minus RAM, DVD RAM. It's almost like a commercial thing. You could make perfect recordings, get rid of commercials, exactly what you want to do, or put together a whole show if you want, or whatever you want to do with that. That's the best. You're not going to beat the DVD RAM. It's set up differently than a regular disc. You can bring it down to probably like, you know, maybe part of a millisecond. It just be on a perfect where you don't get any commercials before or after you're trying to cut them out. But overall 30 on what he has, probably. In fact, he does.
Why do you answer for the question?
Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, but I have to ask this question. Going on for probably Eric.
Keep an eye on it. What exactly were you asking, Nick?
He was specifically, he was using the word EMP, but I think he really was talking about CMEs. In other words, when the sun is going to give you this blast of particles, and your satellites have given you forewarning, what can we do to protect our systems down here? KE2EJ, KQIW.
Can I ask that directly? Possibly. KY2HO.
Okay, yeah. Eric, you might have to listen to 375 to hear his answer, to hear his question. Dennis wants to re-ask the question with better wording. NY2HF, K2RIW, go ahead, Dennis.
Are you hearing me, Eric?
Yeah, we're hearing you right now, so give it a go, and if we stop hearing you, we have to flip over to 375 to hear you. Go right ahead, Dennis.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Eric, what I was asking was, you have all these lightning protections, but what do you have as far as CMEs? And I'm talking about CMEs that come from the sun or come from a nuclear device that's set off at about, 15,000 feet or maybe a little bit more. What do you have to protect against that? And if you have something to protect against that, while the grid is down, what good is what you're doing? Because you're not going to be broadcasting while everything else is down. So please answer. Thank you.
No, I could give you a cynical answer to that. I mean, you're taking something and let's put it this way. If you're really interested in nuclear bomb-proof stuff, just take a look at many of the abandoned AT&T buildings that were designed to be literally atomic bomb-proof. You look at the gear that was in there. You will find that it's all poop. But beyond that, as far as like the nuclear event goes, nobody in the world is doing anything about it. Because there's not much you can do about it, especially if there's nothing left. You know, one nice big incendiary multi-megaton bomb don't leave much to broadcast to. But in terms of CME, where we actually do feel its effects from, in terms of the microwave dishes, the stuff that we point out up into the sky, but there's a certain amount of protection there. But there's been times that, you know, there's been warnings of events, and you had to go and replace the LMB because it's fried. But that's really it. But you know, if you're living as a survivalist and that's your mindset, that's fine. But look, the reality of an atomic bomb is like everything's pretty much black and turned to a crisp. So there you go. KTRIWK 2J.
2HF. I'd like to follow that up. Thank you, Dick.
Okay. Yeah. One more cycle of this, Dennis. The way you're asking the question, I can tell that there is no answer that's going to make everybody happy, because if we choose the worst-case situation, you can always find a situation bad enough that you're not protected for. Give it one more cycle, Eric. Dennis. NY2HF, K2RIW.
No, Dick. Actually, I'm looking for a better case scenario. What Eric just answered was not sufficient. I'm not talking about nuclear detonation. I did put that in there, but that was only because that's the logical mindset that people who are thinking of this. No, what I was talking about is CM or EM from the sun, emanating from the sun, and think whatsoever. And if Eric says that it does, well, I gotta tell you, it's probably, but he doesn't. And, we've got a problem with that. We've got a problem with what's going on in the solar system right now. You know, a lot of people are not watching it, but there is a lot going on. You need to focus your attention on what's going on, not what's in the media, because they're going to distract you. Thank you, Dick.
Transmit on 375, would you?
Okay, I'm going to transmit on 375. Stand by while I flip the knobs.
Fine, I just wanted to know. It was not us.
KE2AJ, K2RIW, 1375. Over to you, Eric.
Just as I suspected. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
There was a massive power outage in Canada a decade or two ago because a coronal mass ejection from the sun issued tremendous number of charged particles at the Earth at multiple million miles an hour, and all of the wiring for the power grid system, your transmission and distribution systems, were picking up very large voltages, DC voltage, and the DC voltage being poured into a transformer that you've got at the power station saturates the core, burns up the transformer. They've now developed a certain amount of protection from that, because that event created a lot of grief in Canada, because we're moving in the direction of high voltage DC to power 1,000 miles of wiring at 330 kilovolts, so to speak, with AC, gives you a lot of loss because of corona and arcing and whatever. If you do it with DC, you end up with quite a bit more efficiency. And the good news about DC is that it has a kind of natural protection from a coronal mass ejection. The coronal mass ejection adds some extra voltage to the line, like maybe 10 kilovolts, which you put 10 kilovolts on an AC line, it creates havoc at the transformer. You put an extra 10 kilovolts on a line that's carrying half a megavolt of DC voltage, depending on the polarity, you either get a little bit happier or a little bit unhappier, but the system tolerates it very well. So many of our major power distribution systems in the United States are moving in the direction of DC because it's more efficient. That's going to give you partial correction from what you're worried about, Dennis. But we've got to move on because we've got other people who've got some other questions here.
Repeater, time out.
Okay, let's see if I'm... okay, everything's back up that I can tell. The, I think Joe... Let me make sure, Joe, did you get most of the answer you're looking for? It looks to me like how you store the disk, which kind of disk, what kind of machine you use. Looks like there's a lot of variables as to how often you can rewrite and how long the material stays on a DVD. W2RYY for any other fills, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think Paul probably answered my question the best, because he says that if he's using a Zenith, that's what I'm using as a recording device, and you can get about 30 times out of one of these discs, that's fine. Well, what that means is that the disc I gave you, he watched his already, but the one I gave you, you better not put it on the back burner and watch it 10 years from now, because it may not be viewable.
Okay, I understand. And thank you. Alrighty, the next person who signed in with a question, if he's still with us, was Mike. Kilo 2 Mike Foxtrot Romeo. Go right ahead, Mike. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. W2VL repeater system.
One last caller. K2MFR. Mike Foxtrot Romeo, if I got it correctly. Mike, are you still with us? K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, we did keep Mike waiting an awful long time, and maybe he didn't make it. Time to go over to the mailbag. So, did you get some real tough questions this week, John? And let's hope it wasn't another one of those weeks where you get to, where you get 100 requests. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. No, very quiet this week, Nick, but we've got a couple of questions here. In fact, I have Mike, the call you just put out, emailed me the question. Instead of waiting, he had to leave, but he's recording, so he'll be listening. Let me let it drop.
Thank you.
Okay, Mike is constructing an antenna, or wants to construct an antenna similar to the one that he uses right now for research.